Accession number 17747, Reel 1.
Was there a tradition of military service in your family?
No. My father was an NCO in the First War in the Leicesters, the infantry, but he was too young to have got overseas. I think he joined in 1917 and was out by early 19. So there was no tradition of military service. On the other hand, there was a tradition of naval service, because my grandfather was a trawler fisherman in Grimsby, and he served in minesweepers throughout the First War. And at the age of 64, 65, he gave a false age and joined up again in the Second War, and only left the Navy when a visiting admiral saw that he was slightly older than the rest and discovered that he was 70. So he was brought out, it's still in uniform, as a chief petty officer in the Navy, and put in charge of the Naffy Canteen on Grimsby Docks in 1945. So there was a naval tradition of a minor, well, not minor, but two generations back. As for the rest, well, my various uncles, my father's brothers, were called up and did their stuff. One of them was in the invasion of Norway. Another uncle, who was a fish merchant on Grimsby Docks, was called up at the age of about 39 and ended up as a corporal in, I think it was corporal, at the army stores depot at Chilwell in Nottinghamshire. But no military tradition.
Not a professional military tradition?
Oh, none whatever, no. It was only in case of conscription, war, this kind of thing. No professional, no.
You mentioned that you had an uncle who went to Norway. Presumably that was in the 1940 expedition.
That's right, yes.
Can you remember who he was with?
Only by inference, since he was a skilled fitter and had joined Remy, I assume that he was there with a Remy unit, or the nearest equivalent, which may have been involved in the invasion.
Did he get back all right?
He got back with less hair than he went, yes.
Do you remember,
he's still alive.
Do you remember him saying anything about
no, because by that time we were not in touch. I mean, I was at university and off into the army, and I didn't meet him, in fact, until after the war. So it was all hearsay. What a terrible time he'd experienced during that week or so when the invasion took place. I can't remember where it was now. Was it Narvik or something like that?
Well, one force went to Narvik, but others went to the area north and south of Trondheim.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure. I couldn't vouch for it. Narvik was mentioned, and his having aged considerably was mentioned.
You mentioned university. Were you at university when war broke out?
No. I have in my diaries quite interesting things about... I was in the sixth form at the grammar school when war broke out. I had just taken high school certificate, the equivalent of A-levels. I just got my senior scholarship to the university in August 39. The war broke out 3rd of September. And I stayed on a further year in the sixth form to do the London Intermediate BA, which I did. I took that at school instead of at university. And I have sort of ironical speculation in my diaries. During May 1940, about my being 3 or 4 weeks away from examinations when France was being occupied by the Germans, and my school was looking forward to the inter-school sports day against Brig and Market Raisin grammar schools. Here we were in this world which might be shattered at any moment by a German invasion, trying to behave normally, and with all kinds of things happening around, like trenches being dug along where I lived, the Cleethorpes seafront. The pleasure beach was now a mass of trenches, and one was not allowed too near certain installations. one occasionally saw cargo ships on their end sinking into the Humber estuary. Between two subjects of homework. So life was very strange.
Did you get involved in the Home Guard?
Indeed, yes. I eventually achieved a defence medal because when I did go to the University to Nottingham in 1940, 2nd of October 1940, I had a year in the Home Guard, which is a requirement. It had then become the Home Guard rather than the LDV, Local Defence Volunteers. It had become the Home Guard. And one had to join it as soon as becoming a student, as well as doing cadet service. So uniform was a sort of half-time dress for almost everybody from my time, from September, October 1940 onwards.
Can you recall what sort of training you did with the Home Guard?
With the Home Guard? No, I can't disentangle it from training done with the OTC, the training corps at the university. I think that the Home Guard, for this purpose, assumed that people who were technically Home Guard as well as OTC were getting their training through the OTC. So we would spend two evenings or whatever a week in the armoury behind the university buildings in Nottingham, and that would be our OTC training, and then we would be on Home Guard duty, which was partly enemy spotting, partly fire watching in the university buildings.
What did enemy spotting involve doing? Was this
I can't remember in detail, but I mean, obviously, we would be looking out, watching the skies and seeing if there was any activity. We were, in fact, in a fairly high tower at Nottingham University, so we could look out over the landscape towards, say, the Boots Pharmaceutical Factory and so on.
Did you remember doing any patrolling or guarding of vital points or anything of that sort?
No.
What was the quality of the OTC training? Looking back on it, do you think that it was a useful preparation for induction into the army?
Yes, I do. I do in the sense that the most obvious smooth points of civilian life began to be erased, and one began to be treated like a dog, yes. Particularly by jumped-up fellow students who had managed to get themselves a pip by taking Certificate B and were revelling in their newfound power before themselves joining the army as officers direct. The dividing line, of course, was between Certificate A and Certificate B. Certificate A, which everybody took it was spread over the year. The whole of the first year was devoted to Certificate A. Then if you wanted to do Cert B, you stayed on either 6 months or half a year or a year at the university. And if you had Cert B, you were pretty well straight into a commission, subject perhaps to a pre-Octu course or indeed straight to Octu. With Certificate A, it was much more dicey, so that this was not itself regarded as a qualification for officership. Hence, when I joined the army with a Certificate A, I still had to go through all of the hoops of serving in the ranks and so on, but with no doubt some sort of asterisk against my name in the records that I did indeed have the Certificate A. The older and wiser universities, Oxford and Cambridge, knew better than to launch people onto the army with just a Certificate A, and almost everybody from there had a Cert B. Hence, they, in effect, did not serve in the ranks unless they were absolutely useless.
Did you want to become an officer when you
were certainly. It's much more comfortable. Potentially.
Was that the only reason?
It was the main reason. It's a more complex matter than that. You partly do it because you are
conditioned from childhood, if you're reasonably clever, to aim upwards. And being an officer is aiming upwards in army terms. You don't easily reconcile yourself to not getting on, whatever you're doing. That's one aspect. You hope that the sort of common denominator of conversation and so on will be slightly higher in the officer's mess, though not always proved to be so, than in the other rank's mess. I think just in general also one doesn't like being, most people I think don't like being bossed about, and it is better to do some bossing than to be the object of bossing.
What were you planning to do in civil life before the war?
I hadn't decided. I was doing an arts degree, a history degree at Nottingham, and indeed I went back and finished the history degree. And at the age of 15, I found in an old diary my choices of career, and the very first choice was what, in fact, I eventually did, which was to get into the higher civil service. If I had not done that, I would have wanted probably to teach. With a sort of jeu d'esprit about possibly doing some journalism. So one might say that having got to fairly senior grade in the civil service and having kept a journalistic diary for 50, 60 years, and I had a fairly consistent set of aims. The army was not one of them.
Had you foreseen the war? Can you remember a moment at which you felt a war was likely, a moment at which you thought that a war was a probability or an inevitability?
I was 17 in 1939 when the war broke out, and I don't think that much before that age one does a lot of forward strategic thinking about the world. Life is too busy when you're 15, 16 to do more than be told or to read the newspaper and see that things are likely, but it all seems very remote. I remember only very clearly when the declaration of war came. Oh, sorry, when Poland was invaded, I think 2 days before, 1st of September probably, being at the home of a mathematics master of mine whose son I was playing tennis with there, and he said, look, he came onto the tennis court and said, look, the Germans have just invaded Poland. And at that moment it seemed quite clear, as it was within about 72 hours, that we were at war.
Did you have any expectations of how the war would be fought? Any ideas about what might happen?
Not really. I think the one thing one did not expect was the 9 months or so of the phony war. You did expect something to happen. And indeed, living by the sea as I did, I suppose we did see more happening than a lot of people, because ships did begin to be sunk and people did get drowned, minesweeping and in naval patrolling, that kind of thing. And perhaps it's a digression to say that there were other deaths too, which one had announced in the school assembly in my last year. They were of people really killed in training as pilot officers and that kind of thing, rather than in action. So the war did begin to impact, but it was a strange thing, apart from seeing these ships sunk, barrage balloons going up, people getting more numerously into uniform.
Were you affected by air activity at all? Air raids on Hull, for example?
Well, indeed, yes. We had air raids on Grimsby, let alone Hull. I mean, we had bombs at the end of the street. But not a great deal in my civilian time. Most of this happened after I had gone away, either to university or on to the army.
What was the sort of political atmosphere at Nottingham when you were there?
Political atmosphere was, yes, very strange indeed, because Nottingham was a place with, I think, not more than about, perhaps I'm guessing, 700 students in the late 1930s. But there was an immediate evacuation to Nottingham of two other academic bodies. One was the London Institute of Education, and the other was Goldsmiths College. And this produced a most vibrant and dramatic effect on what would otherwise have been fairly humdrum college politics. The Goldsmiths students were largely Londoners, and by the time I was an undergraduate at Nottingham in late 1940, their homes were being bombed, and there was tremendous worry and agitation about the war in general, added to the fact that there was quite a considerable contingent of students who were communists. And I remember the Communist Society inviting up Harry Pollitt, who was then the General Secretary of the Communist Party, in, I think it was still in late 1940, it could have been early 41. And Harry Pollitt addressing the students, I went along to hear this, talking about cardboard coffins being used by the hundred to bury people in London. And generally, what he was doing was to suggest that in accordance with what was then the Kremlin doctrine, we should stop the war and make peace. This was because of the, what was it called, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact.
Not to Soviet Pact, August 1939.
Pardon?
Of August 1939.
Yes, that's right. Yes. Well, this had no impact on me, obviously, until I went to university a year later. Although I had been in Grimsby Town Hall, I remember, to meetings addressed by, J.B.S. Haldane and other people, which were casting doubts on the purpose of going to war. There was a strong sort of latent pacifist movement already at that time. When I say already, because of the Ribbentrop-Molotov Pact, I think this never died down until Russia was invaded, and then it stopped just overnight.
I was about to ask you whether you noticed any sudden shift in the line taken by the fellow travellers and communists in June 1945.
No, I mean, the shift was dramatic. I had a girlfriend who was not a communist, but very near, and she was a sort of anti-war, but within a month or two of my joining the army, we were still in correspondence. I joined the army in September 41. I was getting letters asking, why aren't you opening a second front, which as a gunner in the training regiment in Lancashire seemed to be somewhat remote. But the political change was dramatic and overnight, yes.
Have you any idea, roughly what sort of proportion of your fellow students were influenced by this anti-war feeling when you were at Nottingham?
I would say not a great many, not a great many. I just sort of touched the fringes of this because I was interested in politics, and I observed this. I also went to debates and things at which I found myself wiped out by the dialectical logic of these people. You know, I tried to defend the British Empire and was demolished by to-the-point questions, how many women MPs are there in this or that colony, this kind of question, which, and not a real case, but they were terribly well briefed. I was very badly briefed. I wasn't briefed at all.
They had a well-rehearsed party line.
Yes, they had a party line, that's right.
And you were trying to argue from scratch?
Yes, absolutely, and it was hopeless.
Was there, do you remember any sort of super patriotic feeling in the university at any stage, or any feeling of serious hostility to the Germans or to the Italians?
No, I think the answer to that must be no. Some of the main influences, I suppose, on feeling of general hostility to the Germans, not a rabid thing, was the presence among our student body of refugees from Czechoslovakia particularly. I was in digs, actually, with a Czech student. We were ousted from our halls of residence by the influx of women from Goldsmiths College, and we were all in digs, so I never went into a student hall of residence at all until after I came back from the war. As I say, I shared digs with a Czech, and some of our horizons were enlarged by personal contact with people who did know about parents being put into concentration camps and this kind of thing. So there was a growing revulsion, I think, against Germany.
On account of the methods employed by the government in Germany?
Yes, and also, if you were a history student, you suspected that this was simply continuation of rivalry for colonial possessions and this kind of thing. But it wasn't the kind of cutthroat hatred of individuals. I don't know how... I haven't really thought through this. I don't know how to express it. But I'm not aware of any strong current of people who would have gone along the road waving Union Jacks.
Now, what about the students from the London Institute of Education?
Well, I had little to do with them because they were, by definition, at that time, all postgraduates, and they were therefore older. I remember being on fire watching Home Guard duty with one or two of them. In particular, I think with a New Zealander, was it J.A. Lowries, who subsequently became head of the London Institute, who was the most interesting man. I think it was Lowries. But no, I didn't know enough about them. Anyway, they're very few. They're only about 100, you know, in those days, or 150 at the London Institute. It was a fairly rarefied body.
Were there any Jews in the student body? Did they have any impact on attitudes?
Well, on the Institute, I don't know about on the Institute, they certainly had an influence on the student body in the sense that partly the refugees I've mentioned were all Jewish, including the Arnost with whom I shared digs. And you asked whether they had any influence.
I'm thinking in terms of attitudes towards Germany and to the war in general, which might have counteracted the influence the communists were propagating.
That's a very good question. I suppose it did, indefinably. It is true that... I'm thinking of my digs mate, Arnost, who was a Czech, whose parents both died in Prague when it was occupied. And he was on my side in the such debates, informal or formal, that we got into almost squabbles with the communists, and this must have been because he was against the idea of making peace.
Were you yourself an imperialist in your thinking, or were you just doing it for fun?
I wasn't an imperialist, but it so happened that in my sixth form history I had done British colonial history as a special subject, and therefore I was frankly interested in it, and I was never a sort of flag-waving imperialist at all, but on the whole I thought that it was a good thing in those days, a good thing rather than a bad thing, that we had read over a quarter of the globe.
Were your own political feelings strong, or were they still
They were not really very strong at all, but insofar as they existed, and I think most people were unthinkingly not involved in politics, and this meant in de facto being slightly right-wing, because they were simply following the popular press, I was rather on the other side because of various things, including a fairly strong history of trade unionism in my family. I had a great uncle who only died about 15 years ago, who was a tram driver in Leeds, who had become a union district organizer, secretary, and became quite a distinguished man in his way. He became the first trade unionist appointed to the board of a nationalised industry, which was the, when I say nationalised, I say that in quotes, public corporation, the London Passenger Transport Board, in 1932 or 3 when it was set up. And he had been deputy to Ernest Bevin in the Transport and General Workers Union when he was moved across to this appointment. And he was later chairman of the London County Council in 1946. He had come up through very reputable trade union activities. Naturally, I had a family feeling for what I realized was a distinguished, honorable lineage of trade unionism. My father was secretary and then president of the local National Union of Teachers. He was a head teacher. And there again, there was a strand of trade unionism. My grandfather, who was the one who joined the Navy for both wars as a minesweeper, helped to set up, I can't remember its name, but it was a sort of trawler engineer officers union in Grimsby.
This is really more the Methodist branch of the Labour Party than the Marxist, isn't it?
Oh, certainly. There's no question. You're absolutely right. I mean, the great uncle I referred to was indeed a Methodist and preached as a Methodist in Leeds. No, there's no question of it being a Marxist thing. I don't think that would have been understood by either side of my family.
How was the process of induction carried out when you went into the army? Were you registered when you arrived at university and then later called up at a certain predictable date?
Oh, no, it wasn't like that. As a student, I never heard of anybody being a conscientious objector to against joining the OTC. As I've described, one became a member of the OTC and of the Home Guard simultaneously. And the time came when you had to look ahead to military service proper. And in my case, I had, as described, gone to the university with already the first year of university training behind me. I had an inter BA already, and that meant that I would be quite entitled to take my London University History Honours degree in 2 years at university, and indeed some people did that. I became increasingly worried about doing that as my first year went on. I knew it was open to me to put in for deferment, as they called it, in order to do that, so that I would have ended up in 2 years, in 1942, instead of 1941 when I joined the army. I would have ended up joining the army in 1942 with a degree behind me and a certificate B, which would give me this more or less direct commission. I decided against it because I was very conscious of spending so much time on non-academic work. This did not apply to the girls, incidentally, it was only the chaps. So much time in uniform, probably 3 or 4 days a week in heavy boots and battle dress, that I didn't think I could do justice to a degree taken in just a further year. And I did not want to end up with a third or a failure. just because of military uniform. So, although I didn't volunteer in the normal sense of the army, I volunteered not to be deferred.
You wanted to get your military service over with first and then return and do the degree?
Well, I didn't expect to survive military service. What I was determined not to do was to produce a dead degree because of uniform at college. It seemed a strange situation in which to be taking final honours as being a half-time soldier rather than a full-time student.
You just said that you didn't expect to survive military service.
Well, I didn't have any fatalistic feeling that I was going to be killed. Young men on the whole don't. But you put the question to me in terms of was I planning it in the same way as people planned after the war, whether to do their degree or their national service first. This was not national service, this was the real thing, and one was quite likely to be away for an unknown period of years. It could have been 10 years, or two, one just didn't know. There was a huge uncertainty. What I did know, and it was a negative thing, was that I didn't want to get a bad degree because of being half in uniform. And so, when the opportunity came, well, not the opportunity, I mean, my conscription was due to take place in September 1941, and before that, students who were going to